I think that worked. Yep, it looks like it worked. Well, welcome to February. Lots of questions submitted this month, and I'm going to answer all of those questions. I had a plan on what I was going to do if there wasn't questions submitted, so I'm going to weave that in a little bit, and it's also going to be the theme of the next couple sessions as well, but you'll know what that means in just a little bit. So I'm going to answer these questions that you submitted, and I always try to make this experience a physical experience, like a physically embodied experience. Now, the challenge is with voice dialogue, it doesn't work over the internet with a group of people. So I can't, everybody that's on this call has worked with me before, and you've all experienced the game of shift. And it doesn't work for calls like this. So because you've all had that experience, though, and you visited the place where these voices exist, just my suggestion for you during these calls is to listen not just with your ears or with your brain or try to understand things, but listen with your heart and soul. And when I'm offering exercises for you, make it a physical exercise, like feel into what I'm facilitating. So that's my hope. Let's get started with the first question. Here's the first question. What about the feeling of grumpy, which is a which this is these are my notes, which is a nice name for irritated or sullen or unhappy. But the question was just submitted about grumpy. She wrote, does that stem from fear? Does grumpiness stem from fear? Is it an emotion I should let out of the basement? When I give attention or energy to recognizing grumpy, I get more grumpy. And when I distract myself, I can move back to cheery. Given this, what purpose does grumpy serve and how can I honor the grumpy? So I love this question. Turning off the heat. Heat crank right next to me. Now, there's a short answer and a long answer to this question. And the short answer is, I mean, there's basically three questions. And the last of the three questions that she asks is, what purpose does grumpiness serve? And my short answer is ask yourself if you are happy all the time, what gets lost in life? Well, two things get lost that I can think of just right off the top of my head. First of all, you lose contrast. The opposite of grumpy is maybe, I don't know, happiness. How about? And how annoying would life be? And how long before people would be begging, dear God, can I please feel something other than happiness, right? I'm dying here. And it's kind of like pizza, which is great, right? But not for every meal, not for every day, day after day. We like to have that contrast of sweet or sour, or maybe sweet and salty. And sour and salt is considered maybe the grumpiness or fear, or things that are bad. And sweet is like the happiness. But we need that contrast to even know that something's sweet versus sour. The other thing that gets lost if you don't have grumpiness in your life is that motivation gets lost. Like if we're happy all the time, a lot of you have heard me say this, the best way to torture somebody is give them everything they want because then there's no more reason for living. You're like, why do anything? At least with grumpy, we're like, okay, this sucks. I need to go out and do something to negate this. Now, here's the longer answer though. And it's the longer answer comes from asking if there's a reason behind you actually feeling grumpy. And it's a trick question because the answer is always yes, of course, there's a reason why you feel grumpy. But sometimes it's really, really obvious. Like it's situational. Maybe you are injured and you're on the couch, or you're hungry and you can't find a job. Like there's some reason why you're grumpy. You're not able basically to live the life that you want right now, in which case your grumpiness is normal and natural. As for what purpose it serves, to answer the question is with contrast, you know it feels bad, and so it becomes a motivation. Like that's the purpose that it serves. I always say this, it's like my favorite saying in Zen, a good horse moves at even the crack of the whip. It's like if you're hungry, it's a motivation to go and get food. If you have no job and you're feeling grumpy about that, it's motivation to have you start looking for a job. But you have to be careful. If it's situational, like for example, my divorce, I was grumpy for a year and a half. And that was on the surface of my awareness. I just felt grumpy all the time. And yes, to answer one of the other three questions that was submitted, it was tied to fear, and it can be tied to fear. Specifically, it's tied to fear that I didn't choose, which led me to feeling like a victim, like I was in victim mode for a year and a half. I didn't want this situation. I didn't want this fear. I didn't ask for this. Now, here's where you have to be careful with grumpiness, though. For that year and a half, of course, teaching Zen, being all about Zen, it was my job to be grumpy. Now, how did I know that? Because every time I tried to not be grumpy, you know, it came back the next tenfold. My favorite example is that, you know, my friends were so sick of me being grumpy all the time. And we went out to a dance party in the desert and somebody said, here, eat this edible. And I had never eaten an edible before. And she's like, she didn't say this, but she was saying basically, you're so grumpy, like this will fix you. So I took a quarter of it and I had a blast for 4 hours. I wasn't grumpy. But the next day it came back threefold. You know, I had such a bad day the next day because you can't rush the grumpiness. You can't, you know, like the person that submitted this question, go on a bike ride or go for a hike or go out with friends and expect that, okay, that's just going to fix the problem. Well, next thing you know, the grumpiness comes back the next day two or threefold. But then here's where you have to be careful. And this is what I mean by being careful. Can you learn to go on the bike ride or go out with your friends and just stay with the grumpiness if it's still there until it runs its course and lets go of you? Now, there are times when you can get stuck in it, though, where it's past its prime, you know, like, okay, I've been grumpy for too long. It now doesn't seem like it's situational. Now it just seems like a habit, like I'm marinating in it and it's a habit. And usually that happens if you've been denying it its rightful place in your life. And in which case you get to a point where it's like, okay, enough with the grumpiness. Like this doesn't seem like I actually experienced this with my divorce. It's like, it doesn't seem, it's been a year and a half, it's enough. And how do I know it was enough is because when I would go and do something to negate the grumpiness, the next day it didn't come back threefold. But then next thing you know, you can just get in the habit of being grumpy and it's really run its course, but now it's just become your habit. Which brings us to, if you're feeling grumpy, not in an obvious way, then it's a different conversation. Like if it's not tied to anything that you can identify. If you're feeling grumpy and it's not tied to anything you can identify, then it's usually one of two things. Either one, it's your emotions. Yes, we're back to the question, is it tied to fear? Saying, pay attention to me. You know, it's sadness or anger or fear just trying to get your attention. And they will be grumpy, of course, if they're locked in the basement and not getting enough sunlight, as would you, as would anybody. You know, if you mistreat these three primary emotions, fear, anger, sadness, they are going to feel grumpy, and so will you, because whatever they feel, you feel. As for whether it stems from fear, how you figure that out is you try them all on. Like if you're grumpy, what you could do is just say, okay, am I feeling sad? Okay, no, that's not it. Am I feeling angry? Yes, I feel anger. Am I feeling fear, which can often get confused for something else like anger? Yes. And it's not a matter of trying to figure out what you're afraid of or what you're angry about. You just see if it's tied with an emotion, period. So that is how you can figure out if it's stemming from fear, is just seeing if there's an emotional component to it. Now, another reason why you may be grumpy and you're not sure why is if your core values aren't being met, which is why it's so important that you get to know what your core values are. And also it's kind of a two-step process. Not only just learn how to get to know your core values, which we've talked about before, but also learn how to ask for your core values to be met from the people in your life. And also learn how to make sure that you live a life where they are in your life. So, I mean, people will get really, really grumpy if their core values are not being met. And they may not realize that that's the reason why, So the bottom line, to answer the big picture of this question that has a lot of layers to it, is yes, absolutely honor the grump or grumpiness. Honor it, honor any voice. And if immature grumpiness is there, or if it's there for no reason, just, you know, maybe you're not wanting to deal with it, maybe you're staying at home marinating in it, maybe you're in resistance to it, and whatever you resist persists. Maybe you're blaming other people for it, like, you know, they're the reason why I'm grumpy, or it's situational. And it's not running its course the way nature intended and letting go of you. Then it's important to take inventory. If it feels like it's not in line with just normal, natural life circumstances, then definitely explore what emotion is tied to it. And that may be a sign that you're not dealing with your emotions properly, or you're not in flow with them. And then that's when you do the four steps, the four-step art of fear method, which everyone that's on this call should know what that is. If you don't, send me a private email and I'll send you a PDF that outlines them. And then also explore what core value is not being met in your life and make sure that you meet it. And then that will make it so that grumpiness that is there for no reason might not show up the next day. Now, I want to finish this conversation about grumpiness with my classic story that many of you have heard, but some of you haven't, about how one morning I woke up and I was just grumpy for no reason. I was just grumpy. And I decided to go skiing. And I didn't go skiing, though, to try to get away from the grumpiness. I just went skiing. And when I got up there, I found myself still very grumpy. And the grumpiness is, again, it doesn't have to be tied to anything that you can identify. But what I did is I just sat with the grumpiness, and I didn't ski very much. I just laid on the side of the slope and just kind of judged a lot of people and just like was in a bad mood. But next thing you know, it's like my bad mood transformed. And I actually, instead of telling you, why don't I show you? Let's all do this together. So I want you to think of a time in your life that you were grumpy, or maybe you're grumpy right now. I don't know. But I want you to go through, let's say, 5 steps. So we're going to do it together. And again, this is not meant to be an experience that you understand. I want you to have this be an embodied kind of feeling experience. So first of all, I want you to take full accountability for your mood. Sorry, there's noise in the background. Take full accountability for your mood. Now, this is step one. It's right. It's like what that looks like is you're not blaming it on other people or circumstances, or especially if it's an emotional, like it's not because you're angry at something or fearful about something or afraid of something. Like, no blame, just stay in your own lane and take full accountability for your grumpiness. And then step two, here's what it's not about. This is not the practice. This is not Zen. You know, it's not about getting rid of it. It's not about making lemonade out of lemons. You know, it's not about distracting yourself. You know, if you, the person that submitted this question, it's like, okay, I'm going to go skiing to distract myself, and then I become cheery again. I mean, that works, but for how long? And you have to understand that whoever asked this question is asking this question for a reason, because grumpiness is a problem in her life. Otherwise, she wouldn't have asked the question. So she says that it works great to go distract yourself, and then the grumpiness doesn't last, but for how long, right? It may feel like the distraction works, but look again, the grumpiness comes back again the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And so instead of doing these things, you know, the step three is to just, instead of making lemonade out of lemons, just taste the lemons. You know, spend some time with it. Spend some time with your grumpiness. Have an honest, real, raw experience with it. You know, if it's emotional, you know, check it out. Is there fear there? Is there anger? And notice that anger and angry are two different things. So just look for anger. Is there sadness? Is there an emotional component to it? And if so, you know, feel them all. Do the 4 steps. So then the fourth step is, I mean, sure, yeah, go do something, go for a bike ride, go hang out with your friends, go skiing. And what happens, and just feel into this, imagine going out with friends, you're feeling grumpy, and they say, how you doing? And you just say to them, I'm feeling really grumpy right now. And notice that it then becomes not something that you're hiding, but something that you may find amusing or can spark some interesting conversation. Or if you go for the bike ride and you just are, you know, having a really grumpy bike ride, you know, can you find that interesting? You know, talking about your grumpiness, feeling into your grumpiness. So just as we're going through this, I want you to have a physical experience of all that I'm outlining. And then the fifth level, or not level, I guess, tip, I guess, hot tip that I'm giving you about grumpiness is also cultivate a bigger perspective. Like if you are open to the 10,000 voices, you are like having a big mind experience with your life, like you're open to fear, you're open to sadness, open to anger, open to grumpiness, open to frustration, open to irritation, all of that. It's like you are living from a big mind perspective. So allow me, and just do this privately, to speak to big mind. And just sit and be a state of big mind. And sit there now, have a physical experience of this. From this place, look at your grumpiness. And it's like you're so big, it's like salt in a glass of water is small mind, but salt in a lake is big mind. It's like the salt, the grumpiness, the fear, the anger, the sadness in a big, big vat of water. It's just not that big of a deal anymore. So any questions about this? Any questions?
Is grumpy shamingness a thing?
Oh, yeah. And you know, fear shaming, grumpy shaming, anger shaming, it's all the same thing. But here's the thing, you might encounter people whose number one core value is positivity. So you have to be careful with people that grumpy shame you or fear shame you, because they could be just expressing their core value. They also, people, if they don't have their own healthy flowing relationship with grumpiness, will feel really uncomfortable around yours because they're afraid that you might trigger theirs. Or, I mean, if they haven't looked at it, if they're not dealing with it, you know, they're gonna judge it a lot in other people. You know, it's interesting, pot smokers, people that smoke pot every single day, they become really, really judgmental of people that are grumpy. And of course, grumpy is a very light word for people that are irritated or whatever. So people that smoke pot every day, there's a couple things about them that I find interesting, but the one that's the most interesting is their judgment of other people that aren't chill like them, that aren't happy and all blissed out and it's all good like them. And so there's a lot of grumpy shaming amongst people who medicate or self-medicate. It's an interesting phenomenon. I love that question. Anything else?
Kristen, I find that actually people engaged in gratitude, Zen, and all the things I'm trying to work into my life are actually super judgy.
Yes.
Super judgy.
So there's two paths to gratitude. The first path is where you try to cultivate it in your life, but it too often becomes spiritual bypassing. It can turn into toxic positivity, which for some people will turn into judging other people for not being as positive as they are. And I found that the faster path to gratitude is just to be in flow with all your 10,000 voices and also really nurture your core values and make sure that your core values are being met, And then you just naturally have gratitude for your life. Like one of the camps, I think it was the first one, the last run of the day where we skied in the last run of your life. It was the second one, actually, I remember now. I started skiing down, and I'll be damned if I didn't have gratitude that I got to be married and have a family and totally be madly in love with my husband for 13 years. And how amazing was that? It wasn't forced. I just felt it. I felt it. It took me 3 days of camp, facilitating camp and being in flow with everything to get there. But it's like gratitude just happens to show up organically in your life. You don't have to cultivate it if you learn how to be in flow with everything. And yes, that includes being in flow with the opposite of gratitude, which is, I don't know, feeling like a victim, you know?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
When it's real, it's real.
Right. It's like, you know, when people say they want something or they have to cultivate something, it means that they don't have it. The example that I give is like somebody that, you know, wants a new car. Well, they want a car, it's because they don't have a car. So if they want gratitude and if they go looking for a gratitude, it's the same as looking for a car. You're looking for a car because you don't have it. That's always step B is what I call it. Step A really has to start with just being where you are. Can we just be where we are? And then you, I mean, the see it, honor it, it's like, that's enough. The gratitude just comes for free. But sometimes, like I said, we can get stuck and marinate in something, and then we can consciously choose gratitude, but it always has to be step B, or else it'll just turn into toxic positivity and grumpy shaming. If anybody else has another burning question, you'll have other chances to ask questions. Then I'd like to move on, but I'll give you a moment. Anybody else? Okay, now, learning how to be in flow with your negative experiences, grumpiness, negative emotions, fear, anger, sadness, will be easy for some people. It's very easy for me. I mean, I'm teaching this stuff because I live it. I came out of the womb probably to live this. For other people though, not so much. And speaking of no, for some people, the last two ski camps that I did just in the last 2.5 weeks, I was just alarmed at how many people, because I'm really focused on getting people to feel their fear and feel into the voices, and I'm being a little bit more strict about it. It is alarming how much people can't feel. They're not in their bodies. Now, of course, our modern school system teaches us to be in our heads, and we're rewarded for being in our heads. But I didn't want to come right out and say it during camp. And those of you that are on this, oh my God, there's so many distractions in my house right now. Sorry about all the noises. I didn't want to come right out and say it in camp, but the camps are now filling up more and more with people who have issues with fear. And people who have issues with fear, well, the one thing that they have in common is they don't want to feel it. They're at war with it. And so it's fighting back and it's showing up in weird ways. And it's kind of like there's a lot of people also that don't want to feel grumpy. You know, so we don't want to feel fear. We don't want to feel grumpy. So we make up any excuse that we can come up with to not feel it. And so what is it like for me when I'm like, hey, you know, do a dance with your fear, have intimacy with your fear, feel your fear. Well, it's kind of, let me give you an analogy of what it's like for me, you know, call it slime, right? Like, hey, I want you to put your hand in the slime. I want you to feel the slime. And if somebody, a client looks at me in the camp maybe, and they say, I'm like, here it is, put your hand in the slime. Well, how do I do it? Do I use my left hand or my right hand? Where does the slime come from? You know, what does it mean? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? You know, and it goes beyond the camp too. It's like I see a lot of times that clients just start emailing me question after question after question after question. And I'm just, from my standpoint, I'm like, well, just feel your fear. It seems super simple to me. But when I see somebody that's making it very difficult and asking a lot of questions, like clients who write me again and again, question after question. And there's a few of you that are on this call that do that. You know who you are. You know, like what, I actually had one client do this and also request what kind of books to read. And here, I want to read something on how I finally responded. And I think who I responded this to is probably on the call. Hi. I'm not going to out you, but I really liked my response and I wanted to read it to you guys. I wrote, and before I read this, actually, this is what I'm going to focus many of the next sessions on. I know that I'm answering a lot of questions, but my original intention was trying to get people to learn how to shift from thinking about their fear or asking questions about their fear to being in their bodies and actually feeling into it. And this is kind of first part of that. And sorry for all the beeping. I wrote, I think you ask so many questions as a way to not have to feel. Or you want me to read more, or you want to read more books about fear also as a way to not have to feel. My advice then is stop asking questions. Stop reading about fear. As all that's keeping you from actually doing the thing, which is feeling your fear. And then I wrote, feeling your fear is not hard. But at this point, what it is unfamiliar to you. So I recommend start making it familiar. For you asking questions right now, that is what's familiar to you. Now it's time to feel fear and other emotions instead and make that familiar instead. That way you can have your own personal experiences with your emotions where you can discover your own answers instead of looking to me for them. Oh my gosh, I have so many bangs and clacks in my house. Sorry, I'm really totally taken out of the flow.
I think it's fine for us. It's maybe a little more distracting for you, but we're with you.
Okay, all right. Now, basically I'm saying stop asking so many questions about it. Stop looking to read more books. You know, that's a habitual pattern and it's the thing that's preventing you from feeling. You know, and people just don't want to feel. And they think that if they keep asking questions and if they keep reading books, then somehow it'll get them closer to feeling, but it only takes them further away from feeling. So I, you know, now at this point, I'm now going to ask if you have any questions. Of course, nobody's going to want to ask a question, right? But that's not to say that I'm still not going to answer them. But this is the reason why I'm going to devote at least a portion of this call and the next several calls into getting people out of their head and more into a feeling space. But does anybody want to ask a question right now about that?
So when that grates against your core values, how do you find patience for those people?
Well, it doesn't grate against, are you asking about me?
Because when it grates against mine, when I have my core values grated against, there's my I statement.
Okay, thank you. I didn't know if you were talking about me or you. What are your core values that get grated against when somebody's in their head a lot and doesn't
want to? I want to say two is like social awareness. Awareness of the context happening in the exterior world.
Okay. Meaning that when I hear that, I hear that it's like, okay, I'm busy trying to feel my emotions. I'm busy trying to have an honest, healthy, flowing relationship with my emotions. And I'm in the world, in a world that doesn't. And I mean, everywhere you go, I mean, imagine what it's like to be me. You see people that are using language like I want to overcome and conquer my fear or turn that frown upside down or anger, you know, you want to let go of that. You know, that's, you don't want to hold on to that. And there's a lot of emotion shaming and it's just, it can be very irritating, especially if that's your core value. What is your question about that?
Where do I find the patience to deal with that person in that time, or to let the flow of whatever emotions coming up be helpful in that moment?
The patience comes from recognizing that your core values are different from their core values. Like if you come in contact with Somebody whose number one core, and I did recently, somebody whose number one core value is positivity, you're going to be annoyed by that. Or maybe somebody whose number one core value is privacy. So it's the more you understand that what you care about, nobody else cares about, it's only you, then the less judgmental you will be of them in that moment. As for how I deal with coming in contact, especially as an educator, you know, these people aren't asking for my advice. And so it's happened so much. I would say that my heart hurts though when I see somebody maybe whose kid is suicidal and the parent is trying to help them be more positive and less grumpy. You know, suicidal is and grumpy are pretty far away, but it's in the same genre. I hurt inside. I want to help so badly, but I'll say something or I'll suggest something, or, you know, maybe what you could do is give them my number. They probably won't call, but it's a different conversation every time. Hopefully that helps. If you have more questions at the end, you can stick around afterwards, but I want to move on because I have a couple more questions that were submitted. And I want to help with that further if you need more information. But let's move on. Here's another question that's been submitted. Lots of people feel deep down they are not enough. So this is about core wound. Is it always a core wound, or can it also be a belief? Lots of psychologists and spiritual teachers recommend that we should change our beliefs to feel good enough. What do you think? I can also see that there is a truth in not being enough, because sometimes we are just not enough and that can be motivating. Now, we've talked about core values before, and core wound, and I'm not enough is just one of many. But the person that asked this question, probably their core wound is not enough. I'm not enough, or I'm not good enough. Who wants to be in the hot seat right now? And I can facilitate you just briefly.
Raising my hand, is that?
Okay. All right, so Gary, I don't know if you want to, there you are. Just as being not, I don't know what your number one or what, you know, I want to say number one core wound, but let's just call it core wound, because I think there's really just one that stands out, and it's not about figuring out your top three core wounds. But what do you think your core wound, your number one core wound is?
Definitely not strong enough.
Not strong enough.
Yeah.
Okay, not strong enough. This is going to be very brief. What makes you feel better and seems a better approach or more sustainable? So your core wound is I'm not strong enough. So choice A is that's a learned belief that can be challenged, overcome, changed, healed. And consider how much energy you have to put in to changing that. I'm not strong enough. And of course it makes you want to be strong and all that. It's very motivating, but I'm just talking about overcoming it, because the question was about overcoming it. You know, does it work? You know, how much effort do you put into trying to negate that or change that or overcome or heal it?
Lots of energy and time.
Has it worked?
No.
I mean, people say it works, and there are psychologists and self-help gurus that sell courses, you know, to help you feel you are strong enough, you are enough, you know, that you're not too much or whatever your core wound is. And there's a belief in our society that it works. But I think what you're saying is that I'm not strong enough, you know, all the effort that you've put into negating it, it just comes roaring back again and again, especially if, you know, maybe you're being rejected or fired or injured or if some any kind of disruption in your life shows up, would you say that it's precarious at best, the work that you've done, the progress that you've made?
Yeah, almost like Band-Aids.
Okay, so it seems to me like it's just wishful thinking. We like to think that we can overcome our core wound. Oh, now I'm the one that's making noise. but it's wishful thinking. So here's choice B. What if I'm not strong enough is a part of you that cannot be overcome or healed? And then just notice how much energy you have to put in from there. I mean, it's still energy, knowing that it'll always be there, and that is your unique challenge from start to finish, that also takes effort to become more aware of, to accept, not to try to get rid of, but to embrace or dance with it. Does that feel more healthy, like a more healthy practice?
It feels like there's more space to it. Yeah.
Right. And in Zen, the translation of the word hell is no space. The translation in Japanese language of the word heaven is spaciousness. So you're living in hell if you're trying to get rid of your core wound. But you're living in heaven, not necessarily heaven. I don't really like that analogy, actually, because it still sucks, right? It still sucks. But it's a lesser suck, you know? And really, those are your only two choices with core wound, is to try to get rid of it, to change it, to fix it, to heal it, or to accept it, to embrace it, to dance with it, to realize that it's never going to go away, and to work with it. And you have to pick one, you know, it feels like the second one is a lot easier. It's just a lot easier. So thank you for being in the hot seat. Any questions from you or anybody else on the call? Core wound has just wound up being so profound for me personally. My core wound, I don't know that I've said it to this group because I really come to a conclusion of what it is. I thought it was one thing and it's another. Core wound is something that's personal. I used to think that it's my core wound was that other people are too messed up to see or consider me or too self-absorbed, but that's an external interpretation of my wound. My core wound, how you know you really landed on your core wound is if it starts with I, like I am not enough, or I am too much, which is, that's my core wound. I'm too much. I'm too much. You know, and I mean, if you look at these monthly calls, right, like I'm introducing some really kind of outrageous concepts that to go against the grain. And I'm afraid that I'm too much. And I ask people to, you know, at the ski camps, they get pretty wooey sometimes, right? Is that too much? And I cry at practically every single ski camp. You know, is that uncomfortable for people? Am I too much? If somebody wants to really, really hurt me, they could tell me you're too much. It drives me crazy. It's painful. But for me to really come to terms with that is just who I am. And it's like, I know now who to hang out with. That's very basic 101, like, oh my gosh, this is transformative. I hang out with people that don't think I'm too much, that think I'm wonderful, right? Even then when I'm over the top, like they want more of that. Like that's the thing that they like the most about me is that I am so much. And so just that alone has been really important and profound and helpful. And I also, the other insight that I've had with I'm too much is that I want to be very careful how I present the information in my next book about anxiety, because I don't want people to not get the message that I'm trying to transmit about what to do about anxiety disorders. Because I'm too over the top with how I present the information. So I also know when it's okay for me to, it's a motivator for me to be cautious. And it's also a motivator for Gary to be strong, you know, and So it just, it's really a wonderful, dare I say, gift, even though it sucks, right? And more on that later. But Core Wound, I think, is some of the most interesting personal work I've ever come in contact with. And so if you don't know what your core wound is, then please submit questions for next month's call about it. And let's keep exploring and let me help you figure out what yours is. Let's move on because there's still a bunch more questions and we're running out of time. Here's another question. Emotions can give us some valuable information. How to differentiate between getting the information from emotions and just thinking about the emotion as a form of resistance? All right, so we are back to logical questions about emotions. Let's break it down. Emotions can give us some valuable information, yes, but it's not information that is meant to be processed with your mind, or even can be processed with your mind. It's just super fast, lightning fast, actually, reactions without thought that's not easily analyzed. And if you, even if you try to understand your fear, and even if you do understand what your fear is, it doesn't give you even a moment of relief from feeling it. You know, if you're about to give a speech and you understand, like, okay, yes, I feel fear. I'm afraid that people are going to think I'm stupid, or I'm afraid of screwing up. Like, does that make you feel less afraid about giving the speech? Not at all. So whenever we're trying to understand our emotions, it's interesting, but especially if you're trying to feel better, I don't want to call it useless information, but kind of useless information. I want you to see these emotions, certainly fear, as more cosmic, you know, like it's something from the universe that we can't understand. It's like an automatic, intuitive reaction that has been around since the dawn of the first amoeba. And like we can see with animals, we can see that it's just cosmic. It's like their sixth sense, even, like, what's that, you know? There's somebody watching me, there's something stalking me, you know, it's not something that we can intellectually understand. But going back to the question, how to differentiate between getting the information from emotion and just thinking about the emotion as a form of resistance. It's all, you know, the same. Anytime you're differentiating, thinking about, trying to figure out the information from, resisting emotion, asking questions about it, reading about it, all of these things, you know, have one thing in common: in while you're doing them, you're not feeling the emotion. And the message then of the emotion, which you can't understand, it gets lost, or rather it gets tsunamied, right, by attempts to understand by a lesser intelligence, your mind, than the intelligence that the fear actually offers, which your mind can never understand. So I want to reframe this question. How can I get out of the way of the emotion, or get out of the emotion's way, right, to allow the magic of the emotion to happen? And the I is the mind. How can I get my mind out of the emotion's way and allow it to just do what it's supposed to do? And the answer is, we're back to the same thing. Stop thinking about your emotions and get into the business of feeling them instead. Any questions? Of course, I'm just saying, any questions after this, but you know, nobody, I mean, it's gonna be scary for somebody to ask a question at this point, but lay it on me if you have one. You should be very afraid about asking me a question. Any questions about core wound? I really should have let you ask questions about that because it's such a big deal. And then I have one more question.
I have a question about that.
Go ahead.
I felt a little bit like a deer in the headlights when you talked about core wound, and I was like, oh shit. Or no, actually, I'm sorry. I'm confusing core value and core wound. Core wound feels even further away for me than core values. Core values even feels kind of distant to me in the moment. But I don't mean to hijack it to core values, but as long as I did, can I offer just what I came up with?
Yes, please.
I thought, maybe a way to understand my core values is to look at how I project onto others. So look at projections and look at judgments. And that might give me good clues.
Yes. Look at what you judge in other people. That is probably the fastest way to figure out what your core values are. Like I really judged that woman for being so positive. It's like, oh my gosh, she is so not like willing to feel any other experience into any other experience besides her positivity. And, radical self-expression is their consideration is there, which are my number one and number two core value. Why would anybody judge somebody for being positive? Well, I would, because look at my core values, right? And then also my core wound, which is I'm too much. It's like, I'm telling her what is authentically true for me, which is I'm really sad right now. And she's like, she's basically saying to me, you're too much. You need to be positive. You need to be more like me. You know, you shouldn't bring your negativity out in public. And so that also shows me what my core wound is. The other way that you can look for your core values is what you fight for. You know, when I was in my marriage, the thing that would get me really, really upset is when Kirk wouldn't consider me in my feelings, and I would fight for it. And that's another telling sign of it, especially you can see this in children. Like if you don't get along with your child and they're screaming at you and they're telling you what matters to them. They're telling you what they hold in value. And then you're telling them what you hold in value, and they're like, no, my value. And that's, or any fight that you have, not just with children, but with anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll help. Any other questions about wound, core values, any of it? Questions being in your head rather than feeling? All right, I'm going to the last question then. I love all these questions, by the way. A lot of you guys submitted them just today. This last question was submitted, I don't know, a couple hours ago. So just know that I won't be able to get to all of them. So the sooner you submit them, then the better chance you have of them being answered in the call versus not being kind of deferred to next month's call. So please send questions, please send them early, so that you be sure to get in the queue. Here's the next question. I'm curious about the phenomena of somatized pain. I don't know how to pronounce that word. Namely, pain that emerges out of the blue, i.e. with no injury. I would love your commentary. And he went on to write, I have a diagnosis of Lyme's disease and have had it for 25 years. I've managed it well, he put quotes in it, without flare-ups for most of that time. And I'm actually modifying his question to be a little bit more simplistic. So whoever submitted this, if you're on the call, just know that I've done that. And hopefully I got it right. So I've managed it well without flare-ups most of that time. However, there's a lot of inner work. It's a catalyst for me into illumination, capacity, and to see my own unconscious behaviors. However, I have had a couple significant Lyme's disease, he wrote in quotes, flare-ups recently. My sense is this is my body's attempt to help me release somatize the physical or embodied pain, basically. I think what he's trying to say is that the Lyme's disease is here to help him release trapped emotions. Anyway, he wrote, my sense is that this is my body's attempt to help me release that word's pain. My interpretation, Lyme's disease is here to help him release trapped emotions. And that if anything, the Lyme's disease is acting as the messenger. I believe if I can feel and heal, on the emotional level. I won't need the blessing, he called it, of Lyme's disease. And he asked for my 2 cents. So I'm always looking at the language that people submit, in part because I'm a voice dialogue facilitator, and also because I think that changing your language around fear and other negativity is the most important work that you can do in order to turn that relationship around. Now, as you know, I'm a big fan of feeling emotion. I am not a big fan of healing an emotion. And he wrote, I believe if I can feel and heal on the emotional level, I won't need Lyme's disease anymore. Like basically Lyme's disease will be done. He'll be done with it as long as he can feel the emotions and heal the emotions. I would like to have a volunteer to do a quick voice dialogue experiment and just see what we can find. Who wants to volunteer for that? And Gary, I know that you're going to volunteer again, but can we get somebody else to be in the hot seat? No. Okay. Who's Bill? Okay. Bill, are you here?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. So I want to just experiment with you in voice dialogue and allow me to speak. Let's see, what should we pick? I mean, when you have Lyme's disease, there's fear, there's anger, there's sadness. Which strikes you more? I feel sadness. What do you think?
That's a good one.
Allow me, please, to speak to sadness. Who am I speaking to?
I'm the voice of sadness.
Okay. So your job is not to be joy or love or gratitude or anything. Your job is to be sad, sadness. Like you are an employee or a child that's all you do all day long is just feel sad. And sometimes you're here and present in his life, and sometimes you're not. And the self has a relationship with you. Bill's not you. You are not Bill. But here's my question. I'm a big fan of Bill feeling you. But the belief is that you can be healed. My question is then, as the voice of sadness, will you ever be healed?
I don't really know what that means.
Why not?
I guess that means maybe I'll go away somehow or
yeah,
disappear.
Yeah.
Doesn't actually make sense to me.
Right. It's sadness. It's like, what does that even mean? It's confusing and, you know, and it's a little derogatory. I mean, it's not, it sounds a little suspiciously like we're trying to change you too.
It makes me sad.
Okay. Okay. Makes me sad.
Sad.
Thank you for being in the hot seat. A quick exercise. But whenever we talk about letting go of or healing, and I could have also done this when we were talking about core wound and asked the same question to core wound, will you ever be healed? And the core wound's like, what are you talking about? Would probably say, you know, it makes me sad. Like, don't I have a right to exist? I'm part of you. And it leads to more sadness. And so if you ever wonder, you know what, how I'm going to answer a question like this, it's you know, certainly about any kind of language that has to do with transcending negative emotions or getting rid of grumpiness or all of that, that's where we're going to go. But it's the hardest thing in the world. It's like we have to believe that we can heal or that we can get rid of, or, you know, and I'm not to say that there aren't other wounds that we have that aren't learned, that don't come because of some life circumstance. But sadness isn't one of them. I mean, if sadness is is really strong. You guys have worked with me long enough to know that that's because it's being resisted. So, but let's go back to the question. How do we turn up the light? You know, this is about physical illness and the tie-in with emotional, maybe repression or stuck emotions in the body, and that the illness is here to help. You know, I have long said that if somebody has a illness, a physical illness, like Lyme's, of course, or RA, actually RA, rheumatoid arthritis, which is what I have, has been proven by a scientist to be called, to be caused or triggered or ignite. It's like you could have it genetically in your body, but it'll be dormant for life, but it gets triggered by intense emotions. And of course, what causes intense emotions? Well, a host that's kinked, that you're not in flow, the emotions, they get trapped there and they become explosive. And that's how my RA was triggered, a really difficult breakup, you know? So first of all, who submitted this question, I'm really sorry to hear that you have Lyme's disease and that you've had it for 25 years, you know? And if you have a physical disease, for everybody, you know, like Lyme's or RA, or an emotional issue like depression or trauma-induced anxiety, for starters, and really ground yourself, because I'm about to say something that will change your perspective quite a bit, especially people who are spiritual, I wouldn't see it as a blessing. I wouldn't see it as a blessing. And the reason why is I appreciate the reframe, and it's definitely something from Marin County, and you know, it's, but I worry that it's a form of spiritual bypassing. Especially if the truth is you're bummed that you have it. I mean, 25 years, that's a bummer, right? You've got to be bummed. That sucks. Now, do I see, of course, I'm a fear specialist, do I see fear either as a blessing? And this may have been confusing for some of you, because, I mean, it feels awful. And, you know, I was addicted to it, and I have this long history with it, and I try to help people see the positive in fear and all of that. So this may you find confusing as well. But especially if you didn't choose it, you know, if it happened to you, like I had through my divorce, or if you got mugged, or if, you know, you got raped, or some form of trauma that you went through, I don't see it as a blessing either. It's actually pretty awful. It's awful. And even though I've devoted my life to getting people to have a healthy, flowing, positive, inclusive relationship with fear, I don't see it as a blessing. So here's what I do instead. And I want to do this as kind of a facilitation for the whole group. And this is where we'll finish. I want you to pick the thing in life for you that's the most challenging. And it could be Lyme's disease, it could be cancer, it could be fear, it could be an anxiety problem or depression, or, you know, it could be that your relationship sucks, or you're not getting along with your kid, or whatever it is. I want you to just sit now as this sucks. So we want, Zen is about just being where you are. We want to just be where you are first. This sucks. So sit for 1 minute as this sucks in silence. I may say a few things. Notice if it changes or if it sucks doesn't capture it. If so, come up with your own sentence. Can shift into, I don't want this. Say over and over, I don't want this. Notice that there's a sadness component. If so, be sad. Cry if you want. Years. Now be afraid or just feel fear. Scared this is gonna stay forever. Be angry or feel anger if it's there. This is not fair. I've been working like a dog. Don't need to know what you're angry about or afraid about or sad about. Just feel. Grumpy. It's come full circle. Just sit and be grumpy. And life is oftentimes like that. There's just so, like, it's hard. It's hard. There's a lot going on, a lot of pressure, a lot of emotions, a lot of crazy monkey mind. Reminds me of Togsen. So Togsen was a Zen master who was notorious for beating his students with a stick. And if he'd asked them a question and they gave the wrong answer, he'd beat them with a stick 30 blows. If he asked a student a question and he gave the right answer, he would beat them with a stick. Also 30 blows. And then if they gave no answer at all because they were afraid of being beaten by a stick, he would still beat them with a stick. 30 blows. And he was considered one of the greatest teachers of Zen. And I mean, he's super famous. Maybe it's for the blows. I mean, it's as recent as two generations ago that Zen masters would still beat their students with a stick. I don't think that would go down today, certainly not in America. But my teacher's teacher beat him with a stick. And it really depicts just life, because when you're meditating in a monastery, you don't really have the challenges that normal people have for everyday challenges. They're in a monastery, they're meditating all day and answering koans. Like, they need some sort of challenge. That's part of it. But he also wants them to, you know, now be dropped off body mind. Okay, you're not there now. Blow with a stick, be dropped off body mind. There's more to the stick than that. But when you do this exercise, if you do it long enough, it's like you start to feel better. At least I do. If you don't, then maybe do it a little bit longer. And now notice if you start to have a sense of humor about your struggles. Like when I went skiing and I was grumpy and just laying in the snow and just being snarky and judgmental of the people that were skiing by me. You know, I started to have a sense of humor about it. And I started enjoying my grumpiness. Because I'm like, if you're open to all of it, too, it just becomes not that big of a deal. And you also notice, or you just actually have an experience, notice that if you are open to all the 10,000 minds, does it become not that big of a deal? Because it's all temporary. The Buddha calls it impermanence. But that sucks too. You know, the Buddha talked about impermanence causing fear, causing suffering, causing dukkha, which is suffering, another word, a fancy word for suffering, all which is part of the journey, the 30 blows. And just imagine now, as you're sitting here and going through this guided meditation, that you have two choices. You can fight whatever comes through the hose, work hard to get rid of it. And if it's a disease, hell yeah, definitely do that. Absolutely, go see a doctor, you know, of course. But if we're talking about the 10,000 voices, and especially the associated emotions that come with having Lyme's disease or whatever challenge you have, and you work hard to put a positive spin on it, on something that sucks, Or let it or anything go, or try to heal it, right? And you may even think that you've done it. You know, there's so many people that pound on pillows and they think they've done it, but the second trouble appears, you find it's still there. Oh my gosh, it cannot be healed. And the other thing is, if you're trying to see it in a positive light in order to get rid of it, you know, like seeing your Lyme's disease is in a positive light in order to get rid of it, and seeing the associated emotions, you know, and trying to get rid of it, like that framing, right? The universe, again, is too smart for that crap. These are not a blessing. You know, if we, I mean, I appreciate the intention behind that. And it sucks. And it sucks. So Zen is basically a practice of merge with it. No goals, no agenda, do a dance with it. Even if the dance is with the voice of this sucks. I want to finish with Dr. Spock, Star Trek. He took a pill in order to help him be more human. And he was at the bar in this particular episode, and the bartender, maybe you've heard me talk about this before, but listen to it again with different light or different view. Bartender handed him a drink, and Dr. Spock drank it. He's like, oh my gosh, that is so disgusting. It's vile, like, oh, terrible. And the bartender said, would you like some more? And Dr. Spock said, yes, please. Such a... And, you know, Toksan's students, they didn't leave. 30 blows every day, all day. Yes, please. So that's it. Thank you for engaging in consciousness practice with me. I am going to conclude this with a bow. And in yoga class, they always end by saying namaste, which is the light in me recognizes the light in you. And as we bow together, we are one. I really like to, with a lot of my clients, do a different bow. The shit show in me, you know, recognizes the shit show in you, and I bow to you, and together we are one. So the grumpy, fearful creature that has RA in me recognizes the grumpy, fearful creature in you that has Lyme's disease. And together we are one. So let me know if you have any questions. I'll keep the recording going just in case, because sometimes they're really interesting. If not, I'll see you next month.
This is Amy. There was a question in the chat, but I'm not entirely sure if she's still on. She can clarify. She asked if you would say more about explain what you mean about spiritual bias.
Oh, spiritual bypassing. So she just wrote, I do get it about spiritual bypassing. So.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I mean, it sounds like you basically, you don't ascribe to a belief that a lot of like spiritual or religious people would take, that like, okay, you know, it's like more with Zen, things just are, and with a lot of spiritual practices, things are a lesson. Yeah.
Well, you could see it as a lesson, or you could have 10,000 things coming through the hose on any given day. And if you're like looking for the lesson in all of them, you're going to be very busy. I think that the lesson of the 10,000 states coming through your hose will just all appear without you having to figure out what it is. And so it's less active than you think. But it's not passive. It's just a matter of just sitting with whatever that comes out, not trying to figure out what the lesson is, because next thing you know, guess what? You're in your head. So just being with it all. Like, oh, look at that. I'm really grumpy. And I, every morning I wake up and I lay in bed and I just, you know, how do I feel today? And just curiosity. It's more just curiosity. What do I feel? Instead of looking for the lesson in things, which takes you out of the experience. Does that make sense? Okay, thank you. Any other questions? If questions come up in the next month, of course, submit them to me for the next call. Anytime is fine. I will put you at the top of the list the earlier you submit them. And if you don't submit questions, then you're just going to be privy to whatever I want to talk about, which is fine too. I have some things that I want to share with you guys when the time is right. Namely, I'm really excited about helping people get out of their heads and more into their bodies and learning how to feel. And the other thing is core fear associated with core wound and core values. Those are my two top of the list, you know, things that I'm excited about sharing. I'll get to them eventually. But no, you know, I'm just kind of planting a seed and getting you excited about those future conversations.
Those things sound really, really cool, actually. Like the exercises and getting out of your head. That sounds cool. Thanks. This is very cool.
The background that you have right there.
I know. Well, I'm in Alaska, so you work, right?
Oh, I'll be there in a month.
Really? Where?
I'll be in Haines.
Oh, okay. Is that for a ski camp?
No, I'm going heli skiing for 2 weeks.
Yeah, oh, but not as a camp.
Nope.
Anchorage. So it's south of Anchorage. Yeah, if you come up here and you're in Gribid, look me up for sure.
I'll come out of Anchorage for you.
It's where the ski hill is, Alyeska. So 45, it's like 45 minutes south of Anchorage.